Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, Animal Attack time is here. That's right. We're talking about Deep Rising on Kill by Kill. Well, greetings and salutations, Internet. It's your old pal, Patrick Hamilton, coming to you once again from the high seas. This is the Kill by Kill podcast. And of course, every April, we transform from your regular slasher or horror movie podcast into an animal attack podcast. And of course, it wouldn't be Kill by Kill unless we come up with the dumbest theme possible. And so we've come up with Aquatic Attack April. That's right. It's all sea-borne nasties eating you up every single way, shape, and form. And of course, there's only one person I trust to make sure if I hand her a gun so that she can kill herself before a giant sea creature eats her whole, she'll take one last pot shot at me. The one, the only, Gina Radcliffe. How are you doing today, Gina?
You know, I usually come up with some sort of wisecrack in reference to what we're going to be talking about. But this movie is so full of constant wisecracking that I just simply can't top it.
It really, we were talking ever so briefly before we started recording, and you were saying that this movie had made you kind of wistful for an era gone by, not that it was a great era, but just that it was this era.
Right. Well, let's set the stage. This movie was released in 1998, mm-hmm. which I was shocked. I thought it was much earlier than that. not because of the quality. The quality, you know, it's pretty shabby CGI, but it was pretty good for the time.
Right.
But for some reason, I thought it was early 90s. But you know, to set the stage for this, Hollywood was basically printing its own money at this point.
Sure. Yeah.
Like, it was making so much money. That I mean, it's saddening because I don't think we're ever going to go back to that time again. You've got the post Titanic, Twister, Independence Day, this glut of a big budget, very special effects heavy movies, mm-hmm. and you know, now every studio is churning them out. Not only churning them out, they're churning out, like, you know, each studio has to have their own version of this kind of movie.
Right, yeah.
And so you have these sort of, they still feel like a B movie, but with like an A movie budget.
Yes. So there's a bit of gloss to it.
Right. And so you're running into more than ever where, you know, the characters are written very thinly. the dialogue is very quippy. There's, you know, they can't seem to pick a lane and stay with it as far as what kind of tone they want the movie to be. Is it scary? Is it funny? Is it sad? Is it a horror movie? Is it sci-fi? We don't know. It's all a bit nothing. But I remember, you know, because, you know, this was shortly after my daughter was born.
Right.
So we weren't going to the movies too often. We did go see Titanic in the theater because you had to go see that in the theater. But so this was a lot of stuff that we would watch on cable like a year after it came out. So this was definitely, I don't recall, I do recall, but mostly just specific scenes. Like, I who could forget the fucking, like, sea monster chases someone on a jet ski and somehow doesn't catch up with them.
Jet ski outruns sea creature inside half flooded ship.
A sea creature that managed to destroy a massive cruise ship,
right?
And kill and eat everyone inside of it. Somehow it can't catch up with a sea-doo. But but yeah, also this also takes a big page from Godzilla, the 96 version, mm-hmm. in which this sea monster is as large or small as it needs to be given whatever's happening in any particular scene at a particular time.
It's particularly helpful, I think, that it can send its tentacles out as far as it wants to. Like, there's it, and the variable size extends to absolutely everyone. You might notice if you watch it that once someone starts to be eaten, they start to shrink in size. they suddenly become an Ant-Man of a sorts, where they start to shrink inside themselves as they're being eaten by the sea creature. No one could quite determine how big people were or how big these tentacles are at any given time.
Yeah, and the tentacles have their own little mouths, and the sea creature, I guess, is sort of melting people down and like a smoothie, and then spitting out their bones.
Yeah,
because for it doesn't some like reason, bones. It can't consume bones.
It doesn't like the bones. I don't even know if it can't consume the bones. It prefers not to digest the bones. It wants to slurp the meat off as much as it can. And when it gets down to the bone, like the ribs, it just spits everything out. Is there a little meat left on that bone? Sure.
I mean, that one dude, he wasted. That guy had his whole face intact almost.
I fucking love that sequence. Because it's like Summers is, there's so much of this that is Stephen Summers stealing from other people. And if you don't have your own ideas, steal. And if you're going to steal, steal from the best. And art is getting away with it. And in my mind, this movie is art because it's so fun to just sit back and watch that it's just getting away with it the entire time.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly think this is probably the better person gets eaten and then spit back out scene than Anaconda.
Well, that really goes into this movie's history, and I absolutely agree with you. But I just want to say, as a bit of background here, that Summers basically writes this while he's working for Hollywood Pictures, which was like a subdivision of Disney that made adult or, you know, movies for older audiences, let's say. And so as a result, it brings you a combination of things. But at the time, Hollywood and Disney greenlight this movie, there are no monster movies ahead of it. And it's supposed to land late summer 1997. And then wouldn't you know it, because of a series of insane delays and people saying yes to the movie and then no. And then it takes forever to build the sets and the fucking special effects are insane. And then they can't find any special effects houses because they're all working on Titanic. And so this movie gets extended and pushed until the ass end of January. And in the meantime, all these movie studios push out monster movies ahead of when this lands. So Anaconda, Mimic, The Relic all come out before this movie eventually comes out.
When are we doing Mimic?
That's a good question.
God, Mimic's fucking gruesome, man.
Would you consider Mimic an animal attack movie or just a horror movie?
I mean, technically, I guess it's an animal attack because it's like a big bug dude. It's like a bug person hybrid. So yeah, I think that would qualify.
And of course, I read the book for The Relic before the movie came out, and I was very disappointed in the final product as the result.
Yes, yeah, everything I remember about Relic, I'm probably confusing it with Mimic. So I know I've seen both of them, but Mimic definitely stands out more in my mind.
Well, The Relic in particular doesn't stand out very much because you can hardly fucking see.
Right, yeah, that's the one that's like for some reason, it's lit with a flashlight.
It's quite bizarre, even though I very much like that director. But so not only do these other monster movies, it's not like The Relic makes a ton of money. Anaconda is a very good, you know, small hit. And Mimic, I think, kind of flounders. But for whatever reason, all of the extra juice this movie had going into theaters gets sucked out of it. And then on top of it, you have Titanic come out, which eats everyone's lunch for 6 fucking months. That movie would consistently make between $25 and $30 million at the box office every single weekend. That's just weekends. And it continued to do that for 6 fucking months. So if you had the choice at that time to watch a luxury cruise liner sink, most audience members were choosing Titanic over Deep Rising.
Well, you know, because Titanic had, you know, 25% less wisecracking.
Right, yes.
You know, the special effects were arguably much better.
Just a skosh, just a little bit.
And it had an incredible theme song.
I mean, it's got a lot going for it. You're never going to hear me disparage Titanic in any single way, but it just mowed over a lot of movies at the time. And, you know, when Disney ended up saying, like, let's push this to January, you know, that's a quiet spot. We won't have a bunch of competition. They also pretty much figured Titanic was dead. Everyone estimated that Titanic would suck, that it was Cameron's folly, and that it wouldn't do any business. Does this sound familiar to anyone? Because anyone saying this is James Cameron's folly, generally, with the exception of Abyss opening weekend, fucking got their lunch handed to them.
And every time people fucking do it. Every time.
Every time. They're, you know, Avatar doesn't have any cultural staying power. We don't talk about Avatar. Blah, 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 blah. It turns out when you offer people something they just don't see every day, as opposed to something they see all the time, they will choose that thing, especially if it's done by a guy who's the vast majority of his movies you watch and you go, oh my God, that's a movie.
But yeah, every time he comes, every time something is announced, like, oh boy, here we go again. Yeah, oh boy, here goes big Jim Cameron counting his dollars again.
Yeah, the guy's had one misfire.
It's like M. Night Shyamalan's the same way. Like his daughter is doing some sort of film project now. And people are like, right. Ah, get to M. Night, it'll probably suck. It's like people, I'm begging you with my heart and soul, like, please refrain from making the same goddamn jokes and assumptions about filmmakers that you've been making for the past 20 years. Because they are actually better than you think.
Right. And also, you know, M. Night in particular works at his best at a very low, reasonable dollar amount. So when his movies come out, they don't have to do that well to turn a profit. He kind of sets the bar low enough that he's constantly clearing it to the point where he can just go, all right, this next one I'm going to do for X amount. And simply like, please sign me up. So, you know, you may or may not like all of his movies, but he does manage his budgets with the exception of that last Airbender disaster. And the Lady in the Lake, the Lady in the Pool. What the fuck was that one?
Yeah, but those are both like over 15 years ago.
Well, even more so. I mean, Lady in the Lake was, well, I guess that was the 2000s at that point. Time is a flat circle. Yeah. Anyways, so I think some of the real lasting power of this movie is that it's fucking fun to watch. And it did almost nothing at the box office, but it lived forever on cable. It did super well on DVD. It completely made its money back that way. And it has a massive cult audience for a reason, because whenever you want to watch it, it's fucking fun.
And also, I think it didn't hurt that Stephen Sommers' next movie was a little movie called The Mummy.
Right. Another movie that should not have worked and was so fucking fun. Audiences were like, I can't get enough of this.
Right. So I think, you know, when people just watched The Mummy, they were like, well, let's see what else this guy has done.
Right.
And it turned out he did this.
He did this. And the movie, The Mummy, also kind of suffers from shitty CGI. It is terrible.
Yeah, but I mean, think back to when it came out, though. Like, yeah. And people were like, whoa, the sand's looking like a face.
It's so heavily copied. And the other thing is, like, Sommers knows how to copy things well. He knows how to steal from the best. Because even the setup of this is absolutely like a half dozen movies. It's like you take the Die Hard of being in an enclosed space. You take an Irwin Allen disaster movie setup. Then you add monsters to it.
A little dash of aliens.
Right. Absolutely. Even though in Ebert's review of this, he's like, this is a giant alien ripoff. I'm like, We watch two very different versions of Alien.
It's only like aliens in the sense that, you know, a bunch of people are either attempting to hunt down or being hunted by a big gross monster. And there's a Weasley guy who absolutely unsurprisingly, you know, is selling them out the whole time.
Right. So it's absolutely that, but it's definitely got more of the aliens.
No, I mean, they're not, you know, it's not laying eggs or anything, and it's not another planet. Quite the opposite. It's this, you know, undersea creature we have not even discovered yet.
But it's also doing something that's terribly gross to you that you do not want to.
Yeah, no, absolutely not.
There's no enjoyable part to getting eaten by this monster.
No, it seems terrible.
It seems like a very bad time. I mean, I started to make a list about halfway through. And it's like, this movie is trying to be Die Hard, and frankly, more movies should try, because it's giving you a bunch of characters. And yes, they are thin, but they're giving you characters with actual character traits, at least one or two, so that when they disappear, you're like, oh, that guy's gone. You remember that they're no longer a part of the movie. And you've got the Thing hallway panel gag at one point. You've got a speed elevator drop with sparks. You've got the Blob skeleton hugs. You've got A Nightmare in Elm Street wall bulges. You've got Jurassic Park dino probing. This movie is just liberally taking other movies off the shelf and say, I'll take some of that, take some of that, take some of that, take some of that. And so long as you're laughing and having a good time, you don't really notice unless you're taking notes.
Right. I mean, you know that when, you know, this, you know, large group of pirates, I guess they're pirates.
As far as like Finnegan's crew, they're like smugglers.
Oh, yeah. I met the other West Studies people.
Yeah.
The word for what they are is blanking out of my head.
Mercenaries is what they refer to them as.
Thank you. Mercenaries. Yeah. You're going to clap your hands in glee when you see how many they start out with. It's like, I'm going to see a lot of people die in this.
They are juicy meat hanging from the vine.
Yeah.
And get plucked by some predator vines.
It's like dinners here. There's like 27 guys in this group.
Also, it's a little bit unexpected because I don't know about you, but I didn't remember Treat Williams from like a ton of movies before I saw him in Deep Rising.
Oh, no, I remember him in quite a few things. I mean, I think this might have been his first like kind of straight up action movie.
Yeah.
He played a lot of cops.
Yeah. Well, Dead Heat is a kind of an action horror movie.
Well, yeah, that's true. He is a cop, zombie cop in that.
Zombie cop, yes. That is a real thing.
He actually, one of his best roles for my money is a different kind of horror movie. It's called Smooth Talk.
Oh.
It is based on a Joyce Carol Oates short story. It's on the Criterion Channel from time to time. It's got a heartbreakingly young Laura Dern in it.
Right.
And he basically plays a man who like very effectively creeps on her.
Oh.
And like it's a very, very chilling movie because he's basically just hitting on her and like, you know, and trying to make her like leave us. She's literally like supposed to be like 15.
Oh god.
And like the whole movie is just that. And he is very good at it. So yeah, if you want to see him play a horror movie villain, that's a different take on it. But he's quite effective. Yeah, unfortunately he passed away last year, which was very sad.
But it's weird that like, did you know who was supposed to play this role originally, who said yes and then pulled out?
Well, is it somebody that later worked with Stephen Sommers?
No.
It was not. No. Was it another middle-aged actor?
Yes. One might say the most premier middle-aged actor of this particular time period.
Was it Sly?
It was Harrison motherfucking Ford.
No, really? Yeah.
Yes.
Oh wow. This seems a little too self-aware cheesy for him, honestly.
I think so. And I think that's why he ended up pulling out. He
read the script.
Well, yeah, he didn't just hear the pitch. He read the script and like, I'm not doing this. Yeah.
I'm gonna go be stalked by my ghost mistress.
Right. And so Summers is like, well, if you won't be in my movies, I'll just make my movies with characters who are you played by other people, which is what happens. The Mummy is an Indiana Jones movie without Indiana Jones.
Oh, yeah, it totally is.
So, like, you've got this fitting guy where, you know, he's where the high seas meet low places. He's the guy you call when you absolutely have to get there by the sea, but you don't want anyone to know about it. And then you've got his crew of Layla, and Pantucci.
Oh, boy. Pantucci is played by an actor named Kevin J. O'Connor.
Yes.
Who I guess he and Stephen Summers must be friends in real life, because he shows up in all of his movies.
Yes, he does. He's like his lucky penny.
Virtually,
you know,
pretty much playing the same kind of archetype, the like wisecracking sidekick who screams a lot and seems like, you know, you can't really depend on him, but he comes through at the last minute. I just think it's funny. I when I went to go see There Will Be Blood in the theater, I did it before I even knew about the Leo point. I did a Leo point when he shows up as the guy who claims to be Daniel Day-Lewis's long lost brother.
Right.
And I'm like, holy shit, it's that guy. it's the mummy guy. It's kind of weird seeing him in a movie like this.
Right. Where
he's like a beatnik poet. And what the hell is that? Peggy Sue Got Married.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Like her classmate who's like, you know, the cool guy. He's the cool
guy.
Right,
he's a beatnik. Yeah.
Folks, you've definitely seen this guy in stuff. He has he's a little kind of Buscemi-esque, but not quite. But there's some elements there. They came from the same laboratory.
Right. He's an off model.
Yeah.
But he works in this one particular lane really, really well, where he plays a lot of untrustworthy individuals. But he's still so wonderfully weaselly that he's allowed to get away with a lot of humor that no one else in the movie can or even attempts. This is a weird dry run for the Mummy, because you kind of have some of the same archetypes showing up here. And he kind of like, well, I'll leave the actors for the most part, with the exception of Kevin J. O'Connor, but I'll take the archetypes and I'll just move them over to the Mummy. And now instead of wet, they're dry.
Everything's hot instead of cold and wet.
Screaming skeletons and weird creatures that bite you and get under your skin. And, you know, you got a bunch of cowboys who start shooting guns instead of thinking and you know, steal shit they shouldn't. And all that stuff kind of exists here.
Yeah, it feels like a dry run, ironically, because it takes place underwater. But for, you know, stuff that he wants to try on a bigger scale at some point.
Right. It's just I understand completely what Universal, when they saw this movie, they're like, hey man, we all got sunk by Titanic. But this guy can make nonstop action. It can be funny. It can be fun. You release this movie in different circumstances, it probably does pretty well. Maybe not as well as its $45 million budget might have afforded it. But if you had made this for like $30 million and released it at a better time of year, say early August, this thing would have fucking cleaned up.
Well, but I think also, you know, getting in its way is there really weren't any. I mean, Treat Williams, people kind of knew who he was, but he wasn't like a top of the poster name. He was like,
right.
Oh,
yeah, like, are we going to go run out and see the new Treat Williams movie? It's something no one has ever said.
It's like, oh, that's a guy in that movie my dad likes, you know? It's right. Like, so yeah, I mean, it had a few strikes against it from the get go.
Yeah. In fact, I would argue that the two hottest stars in this movie are some of the most unlikely, in that Famke Janssen is in this movie and she could not be having more fun. At least that's the way it appears. And she is a fucking delight to watch because she has not been put into the badass lady role quite yet. In GoldenEye, she's a lot of fun. She's over the top. She's super camp. But I feel like so many filmmakers ended up putting her in the strong female lead character instead of letting her be her.
Right.
And so that's a little, that's a lot more fun. I think if you had told more people Famke Janssen is in this movie, I think you would have gotten more butts in seats. And then the other one, weirdly enough, is Wes Studi, because this is coming after like a very big 90s run for him. He is somebody, you know who that is.
Yeah, I would say so. You know, I don't think he often did like villain roles. So it was right. So, you know, it was a nice little zag on that.
Well, The Last Mohican, he's kind of a
Yeah.
But in here he vacillates back and forth. The one thing he doesn't have is that he's not a diehard level villain. Because he flips back and forth.
He kind of seems more exasperated the whole time.
Yes.
Than angry or intimidating or anything like that.
He feels like a manager that's very angry with his team.
Exactly.
I hired you for a purpose. Why won't you do this purpose that I've hired you to do? I'm trying to show you leadership, but you won't pay attention. He's got that energy.
Yeah.
Where I think the person who gets the biggest short shrift in the entire movie is the actress who plays Leela, Uma Thurman, because she is a very attractive lady and she's given absolutely nothing to do. And on top of that, she is somehow the love interest of Joey Pantucci.
Yeah.
Like, what is the draws these two people together other than proximity and the script?
Yeah, I was going to say just boredom. I don't know. I mean, I guess Finnegan has a lady, you know, back on shore and you know, he wants to stay true to her. So, you know, it's got to be, you know, he has no choice but to, you know, well, I guess it's Pantucci then.
Right. I feel like Finnegan has a lady in every port. So he doesn't have to have somebody on board 24/7. Wherever he gets to, he knows exactly whom to call. Whereas that pairing is just stunning to me in every way, shape, or form. I don't quite get it. And she's killed off so early in this, which I suppose is really Summers communicating that anyone could die at any second.
Well, that's true. Yeah.
You don't have anything against her. And she's the first one to discover that something has gone wrong and she's killed so fast she can't tell anyone about it.
Shame on us, Patrick. Do you know what we overlooked for Kevin J. O'Connor, what movie he was in?
Oh, no, we don't.
Covered this movie.
Oh,
and had the time of our lives talking about this movie.
Okay,
Patrick, he was in Color of Night.
That's fucking right.
He was the artist.
Oh my god! And see, I don't recognize him without the glass brick behind him.
Well, also, I can't remember if he had facial hair in that or not. But yeah, no, I was just looking over his Wikipedia page, and once again, I was like, fuck. Damn, right. That's where I saw him. That's the other movie I saw him in.
Well, that's the movie that dares to think of him as a sexy artist.
Like, yeah, that's a little misguided.
Yeah, like there's certain things in his wheelhouse. And I mean, we'll eventually, I assume, get to, is it Lord of Illusions?
Yeah.
Where he plays a cult leader.
Yeah, he's in that too.
Yeah, that's a glossy, glossy looking motion picture that also casts him as like sex on two legs. And you're like, I don't know. Nothing against the man, but this is, I mean, there are certain things I want out of him and certain things I just don't think about. Yeah, and that is amongst them.
Stephen Sommers and Paul Thomas Anderson have both seemed to have known what to do with him. And you know, I think his quirky, slightly sinister sidekick is probably, you know, where he best lies.
Yeah, I agree. Well, and I definitely think the die gets cast after The Mummy is such a giant hit. He's just, he is now a victim a little bit of that success, even right. though he does not come back in any of the sequels. And I honestly do wish he had been a mummified version of himself at some point in those movies. They would have benefited from it. But we'll get into how Universal fucked up The Mummy's success at some other time. So this leaves us with primarily the mercenaries. I guess there's one person we can get to before we get to the mercenaries, and that's Anthony Hild as Simon Canton, the owner operator of the Argonautica.
Excuse you. It's Argonautica.
That's right. I forgot to put a champagne glass in my hand and spill it.
It's worth pointing out that Anthony Held is probably almost certainly best known to people as the original flavor, Dr. Mm-hmm. Chilton, and yes. Who was not turned into a head in the jar in this version in The Silence of the Lambs. So right. if you see him show up and you're thinking, he's probably not to be trusted, congratulations, you are absolutely correct.
1,000%, you ding, 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 you've won a prize. It doesn't matter if it's 10 years after Die Hard or just two, someone's going to make a Die Hard. And so he absolutely is a weaselly guy who somehow almost, it's like they took a little bit of the, Kevin J. O'Connor route here with him, because he's another wiener who won't die.
Well, he has this, like, I've never heard of a cruise ship being owned by a single person.
Right.
I didn't think that I thought that they were usually part of like a fleet that is owned by a company. But no, he apparently is the designer, creator, has provided the funding.
Yes.
And is the single owner of this outrageously enormous cruise ship that he has suddenly and abruptly decided, well, this is not going to make the money I thought it was going to make. So I have to come up with this elaborate plan for it to be sacked by pirates and sunk so I can claim it as an insurance loss.
As an insurance loss.
And I'm like, I don't know much about insurance. But I don't think that it works in the way that he apparently thinks it's going to work.
I don't know if you caught this, Gina, during the course of the movie, but he is not good at business.
No.
He's ungood at it. And my favorite line of his is when someone's like, what do you mean? Like, there's all these rich people were on board. And he's like, I misjudged the market. And I'm like, oh my God, that guy still exists. I'll tell you that right now. That guy is running Warner Brothers right now.
Oh, yeah.
Oh boy. Yeah. All it takes is for you to sink a couple movies that no one will ever be able to see. And all you get for it is you lose the company, half of the company's market value. It's great. It's super. It's such a smart strategy. What a super smart guy.
Everything's great. Everything's super.
It just could not be better. So let's get to our mercenaries then. Why don't we? We have, they're a smaller crew than our space marines from Aliens, because we have a tighter ship to run here. But very quickly, we have Mulligan, played by Brit Jason Fleming. He's the kind of guy who licks his fingers before arming a warhead. So,
sure,
ladies. then you've got Mamouli, played by Cliff Curtis. And he wants to have sex with a woman.
Any
from
woman.
Every country. I'm sorry. That was supposed to be one sentence. and then we have Mason, who is angry enough to beat you to death, but cool enough to wear his hat backwards. And then we got a guy named T. Ray Jones, who spends the first opening minutes of his screen venture throwing up constantly. I just wrote next to his name, Australian Nightmare. Then we have Vivo. And all I have written next to him is, Jaimin Hansu is pretty as hell in this movie. Oh my God, Gina.
Yeah.
He is so fucking gorgeous.
Yeah, he is very attractive. Carved out of stone.
Carved out of stone. Just the most handsome dude that has ever appeared in front of movies. And I know that he's just been stuck in so many villain roles. I want to see this man kiss ladies. Why aren't men? I want to see him kiss. Can't we have a Jaimin Hansu project where he gets busy?
Does he kiss Janet Jackson in that one video he was in with her?
Oh, that's a good question.
I think he might just dance in it.
He might just dance
and strike attractive poses because he did. Unsurprisingly, he did start out as a model.
Right. That is the most unsurprising thing on God's green earth. He is really attractive. And then you've got a guy named Billy. When Ben Affleck is busy and everyone else you would call afterwards is also Billy, hire this guy because apparently he was supposed to be Ben Affleck, and Ben Affleck's like, I don't do this shit anymore. Click. You can feel like this is written in a time before Affleck has done Armageddon.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so this crew has been hired. We don't know it yet, but it has been hired by Canton to blow up the ship for the insurance money. And of course they don't want to let the person who's driving them across the ocean, that's exactly what they're going to do. I'm not entirely sure why they decide when Finnegan's boat strikes a loose boat from the cruise ship and damages his craft. Why they then decide they have to go onto the boat with the machine guns drawn? Like, couldn't you just like walk on there and keep the machine guns kind of hidden and do the shit you need to do and get out of there?
I'm pretty sure that Stephen Sommers thought that the audience would be most interested in would be the first would be the sea monster.
Yeah.
Second would be these outrageously large guns
that we're told shoot 1,000 bullets without reloading. 1,000. Where those bullets are contained, I can't tell you. I'm not a gun expert. Also, we do not come to Deep Rising for realism, but this is some unreal shit.
Yeah.
And so really what you have is a heist that's also an insurance fraud. It's a long way to go for insurance fraud, but mainly it's a monster movie who hunts, you know, that monster hunts people down and eats them on camera in very unrealistic CGI ways with its predator teeth.
No. He has, what was Anthony Held's character's name again?
Canton.
Canton. He very carefully says, it doesn't eat you. It drinks you.
Oh yeah, that's right.
It kind of turns you into like a human slurry. And now here, you know, and again, as you say, we don't come to Deep Rising for realism.
Yeah.
I guess it takes, you know, maybe a couple hours before Finnegan's boat comes across the cruise ship. After the, you know, the sea monster has attacked.
Yeah.
Somehow the sea monster has managed to consume every single person on that ship, except for the small handful of people who were able to find shelter.
Yes. Yeah. With the exception of Trillian, Famke Janssen's, and again, what the fuck name is that? No human being on earth is called Trillian. And again, no one has ever since been called Trillian. So got that going.
But they twice find in this movie near the beginning and near the end, just like piles of bones.
Yes. Do you know who created those bones?
It was Rick Baker, wasn't it?
It was Rob Bottin.
Rob Bottin, yeah.
Rick Baker's long-haired brother from another mother, yes. Rob Bottin. Of course, legendary for his work in The Howling and, of course, The Thing. But yeah, he makes a one hell of a goopy skeleton. Because if you are looking for goopy skeletons, oh, this movie has
so many goopy skeletons. So goopy that my favorite part, because I was watching this movie with headphones, uh-huh. is when they find the first pile of goopy bones. And they have to walk through them. And they, boy, did they foley up that crunching and squishing.
As much as Embrace of the Vampire folied up people's footfalls and when they kissed, this movie loves crunchy, sloppy skeletons. It's like sloppy steaks, these skeletons. They're littered everywhere.
I laughed out loud because I was certain that the more they walked, like the louder the crunching and squishing was going to get.
And then, of course, people react to it like, oh, my God, this is the last thing I want to do on God's green earth.
And it's like, I've got goop on my shoes.
But like the reason you hire, Rob Bottin is because you want something to look as real and gross and insane as possible. And he always fucking delivers, because when Billy, the Ben Affleck alike, spits out of one of these tentacles because they shoot it. He comes out with his head half caved in, unable to form words.
He's still alive somehow. Like,
yes.
He's like half his face is melted off and he's just like, ah!
Which I'll grant him, that would be how I would feel too. It's like, I don't have a witty retort after that. When I'm a good eighth of the way into being digested while still alive. That does not sound like a good fucking time. And my God, whatever the series of, that is the best the effects ever look in the entire movie. It is the high point for me.
Oh yeah, totally. They really put the bucks and the attention to that.
Yeah. Whereas, like, as I mentioned before, people become variable sized once grabbed by a tentacle. The tentacles themselves seem to be thinner or bigger depending on what you need. One size fits all.
You never actually see the monster in its entirety. Like the size of it is more suggested.
Yeah,
it's mostly just a lot of tentacle work.
Yes. And I think that's for the best. That's how you kind of get the Jawsy nature of it, where they're really trying to hide the weenie of the actual monster for as long as humanly possible. Because once it is, or at least the portion of it we do see, is massively revealed when it bursts up out of the casino set, you kind of like, oh, I don't know. You mean it's just like a screaming skeleton with a bulbous head? That seems like we could have done more there. It doesn't seem as cool as the tentacles. We'll put it that way.
Yeah.
But what are you going to do? You can't win them all. No one bats 1,000. And it doesn't, stop your enjoyment of the movie any way, shape, or form. What I find even more difficult to understand is that when you do see it and it grabs Finnegan up and kind of brings it up to its face like, I hate you. It uses tentacles to punch him as if this creature knows what punching is.
It's like it suddenly becomes a Popeye cartoon.
Right. Yeah. It's like, you're the bane of my existence. I, a sea creature whose thought processes you could not possibly understand. Let me tell you right up front. First of all, I'm going to beat you and then I'm going to eat you. That's how much I dislike you. But it also doesn't understand what shotguns fucking are, because he just blows out that fucker's eye. And to me, he's like, get out of here. What do you mean I only have one eye? Do you need eyes? Why does it need eyes?
Yeah, it kind of seems like that tentacle's doing all the work.
Right. And it's got so many tentacles. So many tentacles of this creature get destroyed. You kind of have to wonder, how many does it have?
You know, how big this thing is seems to change from scene to scene.
Yes. Whatever the scene needs, that's what it is at any given time. But once you see what it does, it's horrific enough that despite the shoddy CGI, it really fucking works. Yeah. It's just, there's so many elements of this and it just doesn't stop moving. It doesn't give you a chance to slow down. And, you know, it takes about 20, 25 minutes for it to really begin to pay. But once they're on the boat, the movie does not slow down for a minute. And I don't know that I've ever seen a movie use more hallways in more different ways.
Oh yeah. Not since The Shining does hallways
feature prominently.
Right. And I think maybe after that, possibly Inception.
Yeah. This movie loves fucking hallways. And it gives you this, it's probably the same hall, two or three hallways dressed a dozen different ways over and over and over again, because this movie didn't have a ton of sets. It's kind of, in a way, it's a bit of a one set wonder, not as badly as like The House on Haunted Hill and 13 Ghosts. Those movies, like, we're going to spend all of our money on one big set, do a little bit of setup, a little bit at the end, but most of the time we're in that one giant fucking set. And this is like, we'll give you one set, but also a lot of offshoots. There's a lot of hallway action.
Very many hallways.
And it's way too fucking wide for a cruise ship. If you've ever been on a cruise ship, I'm surprised, like, after a dinner, I can make it back to a room. And I'm not that big anymore.
I was a little overwhelmed by all the shit that was happening in the ballroom before the sea monster attacked.
Yeah.
I'm like, Jesus, I got like Cirque du Soleil going on here.
Oh, they are mixing so many cultures, Gina. I mean, obviously, we're given hints that he's taken a lot of money from Chinese sources, because that's a lot of the imagery we've seen. But there's an awful lot of hula dancing and Japanese drumming.
It sort of reminded me of... remember in the Simpsons, my favorite couch gag is when they start like doing like a kick line, uh-huh, and it starts getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and at the end there's like 16 elephants and showgirls and stuff like that. It kind of reminded me of that. Like every time you look, there's like more shit happening, and I'm like,
yeah,
and I'm like, I thought just you go on a cruise ship, you just eat.
Yeah, we don't see one buffet.
No.
That's the crazy thing about this.
Where's this midnight chocolate buffet people always tell me about they have on cruise ships?
They go to the crew galley and they start chowing down on just bread under heat lamps. And I'm like, are we going back to Jason Takes Manhattan territory? That's the only other place I've seen bread under heat lamps.
Also, I did find it odd that, so this character Trillian, Famke Janssen's character, she's a thief. Mm-hmm. It turns out to not really be relevant to the plot.
Really doesn't. I guess
it just explains why she's on the ship.
Yeah.
So they arrest her for stealing and throw her in the pantry.
Yes.
don't even cruise ships have brigs?
They do. And they bring that up in the scene where they catch her. And she's like, you don't throw women in, you don't throw ladies in the brig.
Oh,
and
right. Yeah.
Ken's like, you're no lady. And he's like, the brig isn't finished yet. And he's like, well, find a place you can lock her up.
The brig isn't finished yet.
The brig isn't finished yet. Well, you know.
The place where we would need to keep someone who was, like, stealing or, you know, sexually assaulting someone. We left without making sure that was finished.
No, you got to lock her in the same place you have chocolate-covered strawberries.
But, we made sure that we got the hula dancers on board before leaving the dock.
Yes. Where all these people sleep is beyond me. Where they store the drums is, can't even begin to tell you. But again, not coming here for realism. That's not what we want.
This is a giant sea monster movie. So.
It's a giant sea monster movie. And as such, they do find a variety of ways for that sea monster to kill people that are gruesome and unfun for the people being eaten.
Oh, yeah. Like I said, it's not even so much that it eats you, that apparently it's a long, horrifying, you agonizing death.
Yeah, when you're just getting digested. It's a little bit of the blob. It's a little bit of anaconda, obviously. But this is being made and developed. It's being written before Anaconda. Anaconda just beats it to the punch, which I find crazy town. That people are like, you know what movies need is people getting digested slowly.
We don't have enough of those anymore.
We need more goop.
Yeah. Where is our goop?
That is, we need to start a real campaign to get goop back in the movies, and not the kind for the rich lady who puts eggs up her hoo-ha. We're talking just gross stuff. I want to see more gross stuff.
Yeah, I want more scenes of like people walking around investigating something and looking down and realizing they're stepping in person. Because that shit's funny. I like that.
It's the best. I just wish I had come up with specific names for all the tentacles, but I just didn't have time, unfortunately.
They're slappy. Yeah. They're sucky. They're
smiley.
There's tug.
There's swallow boy. You know, there's a whole bunch of different ones. They all kind of look the same. No one ever worries about shooting too many holes in this boat that it'll sink. Is it?
They somehow manage to never shoot each other at some point accidentally.
Yes. Unless it's very intentional. And that sequence in which Wes Studi, we learn, is slowly, for whatever reason, like this monster's like, this one, I'm taking my time.
Yeah, I'm gonna savor this nugget.
Like, how many licks do you give to a Tootsie Roll till you get to the core? It's like Wes Studi.
His soft
is too good.
His soft nougaty center.
He's just got some sweet meat. I'm telling you, around the bones is good. Like, you just want to slow down and savor him. And I get it. I mean, it missed out on Jaiman Hansu, so you might as well take, you know, a hunk of manly meat like that and really enjoy it. And so this happens after. He's pretty much shot Joey in the leg and left him to die. And so when Joey happens upon him again, he discovers that he's slowly being eaten, and evocative of the deleted scene from Alien and the deleted scene from Aliens. Instead of just shooting him outright, Joey hands him the gun and says, "Don't never say I didn't give you anything," and walks away. When Studi tries to shoot him, he's so pissed off. Then he would rather die the slow way than to take himself out. He just needs to shoot Pantucci one more time.
Didn't Pantucci, it almost hits him, but he's like a cockroach. He cannot be killed.
He cannot die. And then Canton can't die. And he goes on this massive chase where he's shooting flares off at Trillian while she grabs the keys to a Sea-Doo. And you see Anthony Held try to reload a half shotgun with these flares. Yeah,
his fumbling around looks 100% authentic.
Yeah, it looks authentic. Like, yes, he is a threat, but your chances of surviving his onslaught of flares are pretty good.
I just like how like a cartoon, like he stops and she's like, "You're coming?" He's like, "Oh yeah, I'll be there in a minute," and does almost like a wide like cartoon step into like another hallway, yeah. Like, they'll never see me doing this.
His hands go 90 degrees and he starts to take high step in it. Be very quiet. I'm trying to hunt the wave to get off of this ship. Oh man, what a motion picture. It is a fun fucking,
you know, time. You're honestly selling me that a lot of the stuff was intentional now. Like I watched it yesterday and a lot of it came back to me like, oh yeah, I remember this part and this part and this part. And I was like, that was fun, but it's also dumb as a box of rocks. But you're selling me on the possibility that a lot of this was very intentional.
I think Summers has a very specific style and he has a broad sense of humor. And here, and The Mummy in particular, it really seems to work. Like his stuff before this movie, Disney kind of used him as the guy who would revive a franchise. Because he had done the Tom and Huck movie, and he had done a TV version of Oliver Twist for them. And then he'd done a live action version of The Jungle Book, which I remember seeing and liking okay. Like it's fun. But there, when you're using animals, your sense of humor can't necessarily be subtle, you know?
Right.
And so he just has a very broad sense of humor. So when it got to this, he's like, what if I took my aw shucks 40s hee-haw sense of humor and attached it to this grisly, gross sea attack movie with all this action attached to it. And it just works. Like, this is what he's going for. Could the special effects use another pass? Yes. And then add 10 more passes to it. But he didn't have the time, and he certainly didn't have the money. And it was all for naught because it was a sacrificial lamb at the box office. But you can really see the DNA of The Mummy here, where Universal's like, when we have the right project, and this is the right guy to do it. We need to budget this reasonably and see if we can't make this come alive. And his second swing at the bat at doing this exact thing is fucking huge in a year where there were so many huge things that came out.
Right. I mean, if you were a child in the late 90s, I can't emphasize enough how crazy, like, just the film. I mean, there was like, it's just crazy. Like how, like, you know, from like 96 to 99 was just like a money making machine.
Well, because they knew that even if something didn't quite catch fire at the box office, it's great when it does. But if it doesn't, there were all these secondary and third markets that the film could go to and still make money. Like, Disney knew this is going to end up on TBS and TNT and USA and movie channels. And then you add that the VHS market is still going and DVD is about to explode, where movie ownership becomes a real thing, where people are like, I would spend $20 to watch that movie over and over again whenever I want. And that because, like, this movie made money. It just didn't make money right away.
Right.
And then they decided, let's technology ourselves into not making money anymore. It's an interesting way to do business.
It really, really is.
And all these things where you could take chances on something like this. Like, no, we got to spend $250 million on it. And if it doesn't make $1 billion, we might have to sell some people and extra props and property. We might have to get rid of our IT department. I'm not sure if we have one, but they probably got
to
go.
We got to put some beloved cartoons into a vault, never to be seen by human eyes again.
We got to make things disappear for tax purposes. And then you were at a technology point where not only does it make somehow fiscal sense to do this, which feels like a no-compete clause problem, but you also have them embracing shit like AI, which is just stealing your shit, repackaging it, and giving it back to you in a worse form. Yeah. And that, I don't know who's going to do it, but someone has to start suing these places where you have to choose. You can either have AI or you can have copyright, because I don't believe you can have both.
Well, the problem is that, you know, I think a lot of people, I mean, people in our industry, I mean, you're a professional writer, I am attempting to be, you know, are kind of relying upon, well, you know, the consumer will know the difference. No, they won't. I unfortunately, it appears that a lot of people don't actually know right away how to recognize, you know, if something is AI written, and it's very sad and disheartening.
Well, I think because a lot of these tech companies have really gone out of their way to make the internet shittier and shittier and shittier of an experience. I don't know if people have tried to visit a website in the last 2 years. It's not fun and it's very hard to do.
Yes.
It's just a miserable experience. I don't care how new your computer is. It just has become very difficult to visit anywhere that isn't Wikipedia. That's the only site that continues to run normally. Everyone else is frozen by the sheer shit ton of Google AdSense that's being shoved into a computer's web browser. It just doesn't run the way it's supposed to. It's a frustrating experience. And you wonder why everyone thinks the future of tech is going this way. This isn't good. I don't enjoy it. There's no fun to be had. The internet was supposed to be where we all met and had fun ideas. And now that's getting fucked five ways from Sunday.
Yep.
And, you know, someone put out an article a couple weeks ago that was like, you know, find our show wherever you get your podcasts. And that's very rote. God knows how many times we've said it on this show, but it's still one of the few things in the world you can say. Podcasts aren't run by one giant corporation. You don't have to pay an insane fee to put out a podcast. And I don't know how much longer that's going to last.
Yeah, no, it's all, there's a huge question mark that, you know, makes me very uneasy about a lot of things.
Yeah, if we go away, it's not because we don't want to do it anymore.
Yeah.
It's because it's just become untenable, and it has nothing to do with what we do. We're a pretty popular podcast in a lot of places around the world. We're in the top 1% of shows. We don't make many dimes outside of Patreon, and we're thankful for everyone who spends their dimes there, but it's pennies compared to some shows. And at a certain point, I don't know, man. I love doing the show. I love doing it with you, but the internet might make it really difficult to do that in the future.
Well, it's also, you know, the we now have to worry about the possibility of, you know, people taking, you know, our voices and making our voices say stuff we didn't actually say.
Yeah, and scraping our content and making more out of it.
Right. And, you know, and unfortunately, with there is a very large, you know, amount of the population, regrettably, that still believes, well, you can't put something on the internet that isn't true.
Right.
So I'm not particularly looking forward to a point where something I would never say or write is attributed to me and people instantly believe that it must be true.
Right. Yeah. You know, if we're going to get canceled, it's because we have crazy opinions.
Exactly. Because we're
crazy opinions that come out of our own weird brains.
Right. And because we're thirsting over like people like Jimon Hounsou and
yeah,
right. who are we thirsting over? Bruce Greenwood, people like that.
Yeah.
People being gross little perverts.
Get these weirdos out of here. People say,
nobody says that.
Nobody says that. They should be saying
it. We have not been accused of overly objectifying.
And, but if people could start saying it, maybe we could really build some traction. Maybe we need
are you saying we need a scandal?
Yeah, we need a scandal. These two people can't stop drooling over Jimon Hounsou. They need to be stopped.
Exactly.
You need to tune in for yourself and hear it. So that brings us, of course, to the main course of this particular gobble fest, and that's Choose Your Own Death Venture. That's where you decide of the many, many, many deaths in this motion picture. If you were forced to die in one of those ways, which one would you choose and why? Right off the bat, we have die by sea creature times thousands.
I was going to say at 2 hours later, at.
Yeah, it's not so many bites. It's the swallowing. It's the slow digestion. Yeah,
it's digestion. It's probably squished a little bit.
Yeah. Well, you're losing so much flesh and muscle that you're already thinning out, as it were.
Yeah.
And then beyond that, you could get folded in half before you're eaten. You got that going for you. Or you could just take an axe to the forehead. Or you could take a compound fracture to the leg, then ride in a speedboat with a torpedo attached to it that blows up when it rams into an entire luxury cruise liner and blow up. So, Gina, I choose you.
You know, when you put it that way, that just sounds like the most metal way to go out.
Well, yeah, winning the metal contest here—that is the most metal.
I don't know how I feel about, you know, getting that broken leg beforehand, but
doesn't sound fun.
Yeah, you know what? I think I'm just going to take the axe to the forehead. Just, you know,
there is no other choice.
Yeah, I do not want to be solely consumed by a sea creature. That looks fucking horrible.
Right. You get to walk around for a good 35 minutes looking like Jimon Hounsou before you take an axe to the forehead.
Yeah, I don't mind that.
Yeah, it's really the best way to go out. And I'm not going to be conscious when I get consumed. I'm elsewhere when that happens.
Exactly.
Just a hunk of meat. Well, you know, Josh Hollis does all of our artwork. Go to joshhollis.com. Check out Revenge Body Memphis at bandcamp.com for this tune and all of our remixes. And of course, go to Patreon, where we have plenty of bonus episodes for you to check out. Gina, where can people find you on these here internets?
I write about movies and television at thespool.net. I have a Substack, ginawatchesthings.substack.com. And I am on most social medias under Gina Does Things.
Do it today. People, check it out. We're on the socials with the exception of Twitter. Fuck that place. And we'd love to talk to you about it. We got a fun Facebook group. We're having fun on the threads and Blue Sky. If you happen to be there, come say hi. Help us be seen and heard by more people by favoriting, you know, show announcements and whatnot. It would really be helpful. And of course, rate and review us on the podcatcher of your choice. Next week, we've got a little bit more to chew on when it comes to Aquatic Attack April. We're going to attack something people have asked us to talk about for quite some time. And it's about time we dig into the meat that is Jaws The Revenge. What happens when you make a movie about sharks and voodoo and then decide to get rid of the voodoo?
... question mark.
This movie takes incompetence to a whole nother level, which is strange considering it was directed by the same person who made The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3.
Yeah, I this could be another one where we're going to end up going long.
Yeah, probably. It's just, and it's going to be detail rich is the other thing. It's just where this is slap happy and dumb. That is dumb done wrong.
Yeah, yeah. I will tell you in advance, folks, that if you love movies in which characters have flashbacks to events they weren't present for, this is chock full of them.
It is incomprehensible. There are
multiple characters that happens to.
I think the shark at one point has a flashback. The shark has a flashback. I think the shark definitely hunts down specific people no matter where they are, which is semi-explainable with the idea that it's a voodoo curse. But when that's taken out of the movie entirely, it becomes a great mystery.
I was going to say, the shark's just Charles Bronson.
And you're like, but hold on, I haven't watched Jaws 3D yet. Don't bother.
You don't even have to watch Jaws 2 or 1, really.
No, it has shit all to do with it. It is the first movie where everyone's still trying to make Jaws 2, even though another sequel exists. There's like, you know, settle down, Terminator franchise. We're going to continue to try to make Jaws 2 no matter what, because none of these movies connect to one another at all. But that just about does it for myself and for Gina. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.